6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name.
Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
Meanwhile, in a sunny meadow... Dang, Abner, ain't it beautiful?
I suppose.
Now this sure is the life. Ain't you glad I talked you into closing the store early so as we could come out here and enjoy nature? What's wrong, Abner?
Nothing, I'm just out of sorts.
Out of sorts? It's a beautiful spring day and you're spinning it on your back in this sunny meadow. How in the world could you be out of sorts? Just look at that sky, Abner, not a cloud in sight.
I'm sorry, Verge, I just ain't the lover of nature you are.
You don't like nature?
Oh, I'm a big fan of nature. I just prefer to view it through a couple of panes of glass in the air-conditioned comfort of my living room.
Well, dang, Abner, I didn't know that. You ain't gotta be out here with me. Go on home and relax your way.
Nah, it's okay. I think I'll stay out here with you a while, if and you don't mind.
Not at all, Abner. Not at all. Just, you know, try and relax.
I'll try, Verge. It's just, well, I'm getting hungry. You know how I get when I'm hungry.
Well, you get downright unpleasant. Nobody wants that. Go on, get something to eat. You can take the car.
Thanks, Virgil. I appreciate that. It's just...
Just what?
Well, you know Funtown?
Funtown?
Yes, Virgil, Funtown.
What's Funtown?
Are you serious? Funtown, the amusement park out past the lake, you know?
No, I don't know. Ain't never heard of no Funtown.
Never heard of... Where the heck have you been living, Verge? A whale's sock drawer?
A whale's what?
Funtown is pretty much the most magical place on Earth, Virgil.
Well, I thought that was Disney World.
Why are you like this, Virgil? What did your parents do to you?
Me? You should talk. Your pa finds more joy in making you cry than seeing a baby smile.
Okay, first of all, I'm a grown man. I don't cry.
Oh, come on, Abner. I caught you in the store bawling like a baby just the other day.
No, I wasn't. When?
The other day. You were watching that commercial for the ASPCA, the one with all them homeless animals.
Well, dang, Virgil, I ain't made of stone.
So what about Funtown, and what in the world does that have to do with your stomach?
You know what? Never mind.
Whoa, slow down there, Abner. You ain't got to get cross with me. I tell you what. How about we go on back into town and get some lunch? My treat. What do you say? Lunch, Abner, how about it? Abner? Are you mad at me?
I don't know that I'm not mad at you.
Okay, I don't know what's going on. One minute we're enjoying the day and the next you're mad at me. Did I say something wrong?
It's not what you said, Virgil. It's how you said it.
How I said it? How I said what?
Like I said, Virgil, never mind.
What's going on, Abner? I was enjoying the cool breeze, the sounds of nature, the smell of the grass. You're the one out here grumbling up like an old bear. You need food, but you won't go get food, which makes no sense. Then you start gabbing on about some theme park. I'm trying to help you, Abner, and now you say never mind. Dang it, Abner, if you don't tell me what's wrong, I'm going to leave you out here in this sunny meadow.
Ugh.
What's wrong, Abner?
I don't want to say.
Well, you better say.
Nah, it's stupid.
Okay, then, I guess I'm leaving. I mean it. I got my keys. This is your last chance, Abner.
Bacon-wrapped turkey legs.
What?
Funtown has bacon-wrapped turkey legs.
Bacon-wrapped turkey legs?
Bacon-wrapped turkey legs.
Ooh, tell me all about them.
Oh, you should see them, Verge. Turkey legs as big as my forearm and wrapped in bacon. I mean, they'll change your life. And the taste? You ever eaten joy, Verge? It's like everything that's pure and good in life wrapped up in bacon.
That sounds like a little bit of heaven. We should go. We should go right now.
Nah, they're closed.
Closed?
For the summer. Something about E. coli.
Dang it, Abner. You got my hopes up. Now what are we going to do?
Enjoy nature?
Nope. Can't do it. You've thrown me off my groove. Get in the car, Abner. I'm taking you home.
Can we stop for hot dogs on the way back?
From a secret location deep within the hills of eastern Kansas, one man armed only with a microphone, his voice, and an almost supernatural gift for hyperbole brings you the most important podcast in all of human history. It's time to escape from the mundane, ladies and gentlemen. This is Stephen or Else.
Welcome to another hair-curling episode of Stephen or Else, the podcast in which I get to do whatever I damn well please. And whatever I damn well please, it really isn't all that much, to be honest. Not a lot. I'm your host. My name is Stephen. And today I want to try something here in this intro bit that does more than just fill time. See, I don't know if you noticed over those first two episodes, but there really wasn't much in the way of substance during this section. It was all just a bunch of me spouting off and again trying to fill time and pad out the length of the episode. I'm not going to apologize. I mean, this section needs to take up, what, 5, 10% of the episode, right? Maybe? Well, if that's true, then that means it needs to be at least 2 to 3 minutes long, maybe even 5 minutes long. And frankly, if I don't have anything personal to say, and then I'm just going to spend that time going on and on and on about nothing in particular. But no more, faithful listeners. From here on out, I'm going to do my very best to fill this space with deep philosophical topics or possibly even heated political debates. Now that we come down to it, maybe I'll give you some dark, introspective thoughts about life and my place within it. Today, however, I think I might get even more personal than that. I mean, really dig in deep and show y'all just what makes me tick. My hopes, my dreams, those little things in life that never fail to make me smile. But even more than that, I have this, I don't know, almost uncontrollable need to talk about the fear, the terror that beats down on me each and every night. And to be honest, I'm not really sure where to start. I mean, there's this level of anxiety in me that's, well, it's always there, vibrating just below the surface, and I have no idea why. It's like this overwhelming sense of dread and panic that every night forces me into the shower with a cheesecake where I huddle in the corner, eating and sobbing uncontrollably as the water rains down atop me. I hope you're prepared for that. I hope you're seated comfortably. I hope you have some kind of box full of facial tissues that you're going to need to use to capture the tears that will surely flow. Heck, you may even need a bucket, because that's how much you're going to cry, folks. Because it's a sad thing, getting a look inside my head and seeing exactly who I am. Oh my God, who's calling? Hold on, let me get this. Hello? Yeah? No? What do you mean? Now? Like now? All right. Bye. Well, crap. I got to apologize, folks, because it appears that we are out of time for this segment, which, yeah, that's too bad. Maybe next episode. In 1986, Marvel Comics decided it was time to shake things up in honor of its 25th anniversary. The plan? An entirely new universe, as in no Spider-Man, no Avengers, and not a single member of the Fantastic Four in sight. Enter the New Universe, a line of comics meant to stand on their own, separated from the main Marvel world of mutants, cosmic rays, and superhero organizations. Instead of the same old, Marvel's editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter, came up with the idea for a universe much closer to our own, where the super-powered, weird stuff hadn't started popping up until recently. And by recently, I mean 1986, which, sure, is nearly 40 years ago, but the use of the word recently was meant in relation to the events that happened over there at Marvel Comics in 1986, and not in relation to our present. Confused? You really shouldn't be. Anyway, the fictional world of the new universe began in July of 1986 with the White Event, a strange astronomical phenomenon that bathed the Earth in a blinding flash of white light. Before this event, the new universe was just as mundane as our own. But afterward, a small number of people found themselves blessed or cursed with superpowers. These people were called paranormals, and they were nothing like the costume heroes of the Marvel 616 main universe. In fact, in this new world, there were no capes, no spandex, and absolutely no magic. Marvel plugged the new universe as the world outside your window. It was meant to be more grounded, more realistic, and in a way, more believable. Now, I was 14 years old at the time, and I thought it was possibly the coolest thing to ever happen in comics. I mean, this was my chance to get in at the ground level with a brand new universe, and it was from Marvel Comics. But, well, let's just say reality hit a bit harder than I had expected. You see, creating a new universe isn't exactly easy, especially when your original budget of $120,000 is slashed to practically nothing. Top-tier creators were replaced with newcomers or folks who hadn't quite broken through, and the entire thing ended up being rushed to print under enormous deadlines. As a result, the new universe didn't quite have the staying power or the polish that Marvel had promised, and it certainly didn't go as smoothly as anyone had hoped. Marvel introduced 8 titles under the new universe banner, and each had its own unique spin on what a superhero story could be in this realistic setting. Tell you what, let me give you a quick rundown of what we're dealing with here. First, there was Starbrand. This was created by Jim Shooter himself. This was essentially the flagship title. It was about a guy named Ken Connell who received an otherworldly power called the Starbrand from a mysterious visitor. Now, Ken's big dilemma was figuring out the best, most responsible way to use this newfound power, which, let's be honest, is a pretty hefty responsibility for a guy who just got superpowers out of nowhere. Next was DP7, created by Mark Gruenwald. It was about a group of paranormals on the run from a sinister medical facility set up to deal with the paranormal population explosion that was caused by the White Event. The book was a mix of horror and suspense, as these paranormals were more like outcasts and survivors than they were heroes. Then we got Justice, which was courtesy of Archie Goodwin. This was a bit more on the fantastic side for, you know, a supposedly realistic world, because Justice was an alien knight who had been exiled to Earth, which, I don't know, even for the new universe, it felt a little out of place. But hey, he delivered justice to evildoers, which is pretty straightforward and pretty satisfying. Then there was Kickers Incorporated, which, believe it or not, followed a group of ex-pro football players turned heroes for hire. They were led by the quarterback, Jack, a super strong, super fast, and super invulnerable powerhouse who got his powers in the wide event, but tragically lost his brother in the process. So, yeah, imagine the A-team meets the NFL, and you've got a pretty good idea of the Kickers vibe. Next up comes Mark Hazard Merc. This was also an unusual title for the new universe. It focused on a Vietnam vet turned soldier of fortune whose mercenary lifestyle had cost him everything but his skill with a gun. Mark was a gritty, violent character. I mean, a tough guy in the purest sense. After that, we get Nightmask, another title with Archie Goodwin's fingerprints all over it. And this starred Keith Remsen, a counselor who could enter people's dreams. His sister Teddy assisted him, and together they used Keith's ability to help people overcome trauma. It was part superhero story, part psychological thriller. Then we had Psi-Force, which was basically your classic team book. Psi-Force followed a group of paranormals on the run from a government that wanted to exploit them. These paranormals could combine their abilities to form a powerful psionic entity called the Psi-Hawk, which was basically their not-so-subtle answer to teamwork makes the dream work, or cooperation makes the impossible possible. Finally, there was Spitfire and the Troubleshooters, about a professor named Jenny Swenson who wore her father's Max armor, a construction suit turned weapon of war. She was joined by a group of prankster students who had the combined maturity level of your average school lunchroom. The book eventually evolved and rebranded as Codename Spitfire, but despite the fact that it was one of my favorites, it never really took off. At the time, the new universe was heavily marketed, with Marvel hyping it up as the next evolution of superhero storytelling. But things quickly went sideways. Shooter's ambitious plans for realism didn't resonate with readers, especially when realism got stretched thin with stories about alien knights and a football team that moonlighted as a superhero squad. Add to that a whole bunch of production issues, a shoestring budget, and major staff turnover, and you had a recipe for a shaky launch. To make matters worse, Shooter's other responsibilities meant he couldn't focus on keeping the new universe in line, which led to a lot of story inconsistencies. Justice, for example, went from being a cosmic defender to a hallucinating serial killer targeting paranormals. And their flagship title, Starbrand? Well, that title eventually became all about the power of the Starbrand object rather than the man wielding it. Despite all the issues, however, I can't say that the new universe was a total flop. It was actually more of an experiment that had gone a bit awry. Some titles had promise, but the overall execution didn't deliver the fresh start that Marvel had envisioned. Eventually, with Shooter's departure, the remaining creative teams tried to save what they could by toning down the sci-fi, trimming the line, and cutting back on the more fantastic elements. But even with these efforts, the new universe just didn't have the lasting impact that Marvel fans, myself included, had hoped for. Now, if you were a Marvel fan back then, you might have been used to gods, mutants, cosmic battles, and world-threatening stakes, all tied up in monthly adventures with a certain formula. But Starbrand, that wasn't exactly the vibe it was going for. Instead of a sleek, shiny superhero, we got Ken Connell, a regular guy in Pennsylvania, fumbling his way through an extraordinary power he didn't fully understand. Jim Shooter, the writer, and then editor-in-chief at Marvel, wasn't trying to give us another Captain America or even another Iron Man. No, he gave us a guy who on the surface was pretty unremarkable. Ken had his flaws, his insecurities, and his doubts, which ultimately made him feel more relatable, even if he wasn't particularly likable at the time. I recently revisited Starbrand number one, and what struck me, apart, of course, from the 80s nostalgia, was just how different it felt from other superhero origins of that era. Starbrand didn't open with an earth-shattering crisis or a call to greatness. Instead, it was a quieter story, a slow build that felt as much about discovery and mystery as it was about heroism. The creative team on this one was stacked. Jim Shooter wrote it. John Romita Jr. handled the pencils. The inks were by Al Williams. The letters were by Joe Rosen. The colors were by Christy Scheel. And Michael Higgins was the editor. They knew how to draw readers into a story that didn't necessarily need to be explosive. And yet, it hooked you right away from that very first page. Stephen or Else will return after these messages. For some folks, a clamp is a tool, but for others, it's an art form. In a world of fleeting connections, there are only a few bonds that endure. Clamps for Life is more than a service. It's a promise, a mark of quality forged by artisans with the finest steel, crafted for those who value the precision of a perfect hold. Imagine a clamp forged in the old world traditions, its polished steel glinting under a low evening light. This is no ordinary tool. This is a testament to a life lived elegantly, where every detail, every connection is bound with intention. You know the feeling, the quiet assurance of a frame held flawlessly, a bond unbreakable. Whether securing the golden seams of a Baroque mirror, stabilizing the oak beams of a coastal retreat in the south of France, or gently holding your most precious works of art, this is the world of Clamps for Life. Every month, Clamps for Life delivers only the finest hand-selected clamps to your door, chosen specifically for your needs. Clamps that speak of sophistication, craftsmanship, and permanence. Designed for those who believe that even a clamp should embody the spirit of beauty, precision, and integrity. With your first delivery, you'll receive an exclusive custom milled miter clamp, not merely functional, but designed to elevate your surroundings. Because Clamps for Life is for those that believe stability is the ultimate luxury. Join us. Join the select few who understand that elegance is found in what we hold close and in what holds us together. Clamps for Life, for those who demand nothing less than perfection. And now back to Stephen or Else. So the issue opens with a splash page on which a guy in red holds a train engine over his head. This doesn't actually really occur until later in the issue as far as the story goes, but it's just a beautifully drawn page. And it does make you want to keep reading, or at least it made me want to keep reading. We turn the page and we are in the Laurel Mountains in western Pennsylvania. The fella from the previous page, Ken Connell, he's riding a motorcycle. It's a dirt bike and he's off-road having some fun when he comes across an area of wilderness that looks as if it's been bombed. He finds it curious. Huh, this looks like maybe a bomb went off. So he moves on higher up the mountain so that he can look down upon the blast area. It's here that he meets an old man. The old fella, he's got this long white beard. He's at least a foot taller than Ken. And he alludes to being in a fight. He tells Ken he has something to give him. And Ken, he's actually pretty nonchalant about the whole thing. He just tells the guy, all right, we'll make it quick. We're running out of daylight. The old man tells Ken to look into his eyes. And in the very next panel, Ken is waking up the next morning, still on the mountain, and he's covered in dew. Mountain dew, if you want to get technical. I prefer the diet Mountain Dew myself, but that's, you know, it's because I'm on a diet. Anyway, he's a bit confused at first. And then he starts to remember a little bit of what happened. The old guy had showed him a star-like tattoo on his forearm. This is the Star brand. He tells Ken to place his hand over it, and the tattoo transfers over to Ken's palm. Ken, back in the present, tries to scrub the Star brand tattoo from his palm, but of course, it won't come off. And it's as I'm thinking about this scene and thinking about the dude's name that I realize he is a tall, blonde dude, and his name is Ken. I mean, he does very much look like a Ken doll. Just wanted to throw that out. Anyway, we go back to Ken. He tries to scrub the star brand from his palm. It won't come off. The old fella's no longer around, but Ken follows his tracks to a cliff, and he looks down, and he finds the guy's lifeless corpse there at the bottom of this cliff. And it's like a 100-foot drop, but Ken just leaps down like he's stepping off of a curb, and he quickly discovers that the old man isn't actually human. He's some sort of alien. Dead alien, sure, but alien all the same. And so, you know, he tries not to dwell on it too much. He's like, huh, he's an alien. So then he buries the old guy by pulling out a giant section of the cliff, parking the guy behind it, and then sealing him in before flying back up to the top of the cliff and driving away on his dirt bike. This whole scene here, the leaping from atop the cliff, moving giant sections of earth, and flying, it's all just fairy handled. It's like Ken doesn't even realize it's like Ken doesn't even realize he's doing it. It's like he just does this all the time. It's just something that he does, and he doesn't really realize. At least that's how it's handled. That's the way I read it. He doesn't make any remarks about it. He's not like, "Great Scott, I'm flying." He just does it like it's no big deal. Back at home, he takes some time to have a Coke and think about his powers. He places his hand in the flame of one of the burners on his stove to prove to himself that he can't be hurt. He lifts his couch in the air and cracks his ceiling. He takes a 30-pound dumbbell and squishes it, and then he flies from his house to go visit his friend Myron. He confides in Myron, who, of course, doesn't believe him, and so Ken shows him what he can do. And Myron's sufficiently impressed. In fact, his exact words are, "My word, how are you doing that?" That's when a tentacle-fingered alien shows up and just starts shooting the place up with his weird, flat, magnetic guns. And I only say they're magnetic because he's got one that's just like stuck to the front of him. And they're kind of a weird, they're flat. They're just flat. They're weird looking. I don't know if they were meant to be. I'm assuming so. That seems like a big art mistake to make. But they were just weird-looking guns. Ken deduces that the alien is there for the star brand, and so he flies away, forcing the alien to give chase, thus taking his friend out of danger. He leads the alien to a slag dump where they commence to throw him down. At one point, Ken picks up a train engine, which is what we saw on page one, but he's not wearing the red suit yet, so I'm not really sure what's up with that. I don't know. I don't know if that opening page then was supposed to be more of a pinup. I don't know. Anyway, the alien is about to kick his butt when Ken uses the star brand to create a massive explosion, which levels the slag dump. Once the dust is cleared, Myron walks up wielding a baseball bat and finds Ken sitting naked atop a mound of rubble. When Myron remarks about Ken's nudity, Ken explains that his clothes must have been burned away, which is cool because, he'd wet his pants. 90 minutes later, Ken arrives in borrowed clothes at the home of one Debbie the Duck, a friend of Ken's whom he spends the night with because he's lost his wallet and keys in the explosion and he can't get back into his apartment. The next morning, he flies out to the site where he buried old man alien to find the body missing, and instead, the red suit is there that he's wearing on the cover and that he's wearing on the front page. The front page? The first page, not the front page. Anyway, the red suit's there. The old man's gone. In his place is the red suit. That night, we meet Ken's girlfriend and single mom of two, Barbara Petrovic. She's very much in love with Ken, but he's unwilling to really commit to anything. He kind of comes off as a bit of a jerk a time or two in this series, from what I remember. But you know what? That actually made him feel more real to me. Anyway, after the kids have gone to bed, they later find her little girl, Lori, standing in her room like a robot, holding one of those weird, flat, alien guns. Ken takes it from her, and with little explanation, other than exclaiming that he thought he was dead, rushes out into the night, leaving poor Barbara confused and worried. He flies around a bit looking for the alien he thought he'd killed at the slag dump, but soon gives up and goes back to his apartment. Myron calls to tell Ken that the FBI have been snooping around asking questions, but he didn't tell him anything. Debbie Duck swings by to let Ken know that his boss told her that if Ken doesn't show up at work tomorrow, he's going to be fired. So the next morning he goes to work. That's where we find out he's a mechanic. After work, he puts on the new red suit, which resembles the riding leathers he was wearing when he met Old Man Alien
And then he sets out to find the other alien. He finds it in the mountains, standing about as the spaceship rises out of the ground. They fight, but this time Ken has the upper hand because, as he said, he's angry. He tosses the alien onto his ship, shouting, "Get off my planet!" And the alien ship zooms away, leaving Ken to declare that he has the Star Brand now, and he's going to keep it if he has to kick every butt in the universe. And, that's how the issue ends. Now, Star Brand, to me, was the flagship title of the new universe. I don't know if it was meant to be. I feel like because the new universe was a Jim Shooter thing, and Jim Shooter wrote it, that Star Brand was meant to be the flagship title. It was definitely my favorite. And at the time, back in 1986, I had no real idea who John Romita Jr. was. I mean, I didn't really pay all that much attention to the credits in a book back then. I just knew that the book looked pretty rad. But then at some point in the 90s, I really started to pay attention to who the creators were. And, I had my favorites and I'd follow them from book to book. And I recall at some point back then reading some random book by John Romita Jr. And something in my memory as I was reading that book just triggered something that got me thinking about Star Brand. So I dug through my boxes, pulled out the collection, and bam, there was John Romita Jr. art. I was like, whoa, John Romita Jr. on Star Brand? Now, I know that this would have been sometime around 91, because I remember I had been reading Ghost Rider at the time. This is the Danny Ketch Ghost Rider. And in fact, the issue that got me reading Ghost Rider was number 15, which had that glow-in-the-dark cover, the Ghost Rider skull with the flames, if anybody remembers. The art on the book at that point was done exclusively by Mark Texaria. And as far as I was concerned, no one could do Ghost Rider better. I mean, Mark Texaria, I felt, had been born to draw that book. And as far as I knew, because I really didn't know much back then, and I still don't, Ghost Rider was his first book. Now, what does this have to do with the new universe? I'm getting to that. Well, after making the John Romita Jr. Star Brand discovery, I decided to look through the other new universe books to see who the creators were and was just freaking blown away to realize that the art on Psi-Force was done by Mark Texaria. I thought that was pretty cool. I don't remember any of the creators on any others. I know John Byrne was involved in the Star Brand later. But those two were not, I guess, big names, John Romita Jr. and Mark Texaria. They weren't big names at the time, and then they became big names. So, I thought that was pretty cool. Now, I still have strong feelings for the new universe. Star Brand, Psi-Force, DP7, Spitfire, those were my books. I read all of them, but like I said earlier, those were the four that I kept up on until the end. The new universe, in my opinion, was a bold idea for Marvel and one that could have been a much bigger hit had the execution gone a little bit better. One thing I can tell you for sure, I'm going to be diving back into the new universe over the next few months and swimming in all that nostalgia. And I know that Marvel has gone back to that stuff now and again over the years, but none of it has ever felt like it did back in 86, which only proves the point that you can never go home again.
I learn something new every day. For example, did you know that the average human circulatory system is over 60,000 miles long? I know it sounds like something you'd hear from a guy who swears he met Bigfoot selling them big foam fingers in the parking lot of your local Walmart, but it's true. According to the Franklin Institute, a child's blood vessels, veins, arteries, and capillaries laid out end to end would cover that distance. By adulthood, our network of vessels grows to an astonishing 100,000 miles, enough to circle the Earth four times. So how do blood vessels stretch so far? Well, it's all thanks to a clever system with three main types of vessels: arteries, veins, and capillaries. Arteries are the body's superhighways, transporting oxygen-rich blood from the heart to every corner. These thick, muscular vessels are responsible for the familiar thump thump you can feel on your wrist or neck. Veins, on the other hand, carry oxygen-depleted blood back to the heart for a refill. They're thinner than arteries and equipped with one-way valves that prevent blood from flowing backward, especially in your legs, where they fight against gravity all day. Then we have the capillaries, the real MVPs. They're tiny, with walls so narrow that red blood cells pass through single file. These small vessels connect arteries to veins, allowing the actual exchange of oxygen, nutrients, and waste between blood and tissues. This extensive network is what adds up to that astonishing 100,000-mile total. But how does the body keep all this blood moving without a hitch? The heart. About the size of your fist, it tirelessly pumps about 2,000 gallons of blood every day, powered by the sinoatrial node in its right atrium. This node keeps your heart's four chambers beating in sync around 100,000 times a day. The purpose of this system? Oxygen delivery. Your cells need oxygen to function, and the circulatory system is their delivery service. The brain alone demands about 20% of your body's oxygen, which is why even brief interruptions in blood flow can be so dangerous. Your blood vessels are also impressively adaptive. When you're hot, they expand near the skin surface to help cool you down. When you're cold, they contract to retain warmth. They even repair themselves constantly, especially the hardworking capillaries, and can grow new vessels if necessary, a process called angiogenesis. And have you ever wondered why you can feel your pulse in spots like your wrist? It's because arteries pass close to the skin in these areas, allowing you to feel the heart's beat directly. This pulse is a reminder of the heart's relentless work, even when you're resting. So what's the takeaway? Your circulatory system may be vast and complex, but it's also adaptable and resilient. By maintaining a healthy lifestyle, regular exercise, a balanced diet, and good habits, you can support your heart and blood vessels, keeping them in top shape. Neglect them, though, and you risk issues like high blood pressure or plaque buildup, which can restrict blood flow and lead to heart disease. As we age, our circulatory system does undergo natural changes, with arteries and veins losing some elasticity, but staying active and eating well helps keep things running smoothly. In short, our circulatory system is a 100,000-mile marvel, tirelessly pumping, adapting, and regenerating to keep us going. And that's something I learned today. And now it's time for a segment that we're calling Adventures in Customer Service. In this debut installment, we listen in on a call from Ask the Abners, America's most popular call-in radio show, in which Abner Franks and his father, who's also called Abner, answers questions from inquiring listeners who are located all across the country. We take you now to Abner's father, Abner, who's answering calls alone.
Ask the Abners. This is Abner. What problem can I solve for you today?
Yes, hello. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Yes, sir. How can I help you today?
Well, I need to know what to feed an apartment goat.
What's an apartment goat?
Oh, well, it's a goat that I keep in my apartment. His name's Dave.
Why in the world would you want to keep a goat in your apartment?
It's a long story.
Tell it, friend. We got time.
Well, Dave followed me home from work 6 years ago, and since he didn't have a collar or a tag or anything, I took him inside, and now he lives with me.
That's it?
That's it.
What's your name, friend?
David.
Your name is David?
Yes.
Your name is David, and you have a goat named Dave living with you in your apartment because it followed you from home 6 years ago?
That's right.
Well, that's weird.
Is it?
Yes, David. It's weird that you live with a goat in your apartment.
Well,
Goats ain't supposed to be living in apartment buildings, David. They live on farms or in the wild. I mean, what do you feed it?
That's what I'm asking you.
What?
That's the whole reason I'm calling today. I don't know what to feed Dave.
You don't know what to feed him?
That's correct.
The goat's been living with you for 6 years, David.
Yes, that's correct.
So what have you been feeding him the whole time?
Well, I've been feeding him cheese puffs.
Cheese puffs? Seriously? Should goats be eating cheese puffs?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm calling.
And you felt that 6 years into this goat's diet was the right time to ask?
You know what? You're a bit of a jerk, aren't you?
You've been feeding that goat nothing but cheese puffs for 6 years, and I'm the jerk?
Yes. Yes, you are. I just had one simple question, and all you can do is insult me.
Fine. You want to know what goats eat?
I do.
Goats eat hay and grass and weeds and grain. They even like to nibble on tree bark now and again. What they don't eat, David, is cheese puffs.
But Dave lives in my apartment. Where am I supposed to get grass and hay and stuff?
Oh, good Lord. Is there a punchline coming up anytime soon?
What?
The punchline. The punchline to this bit. I mean, it's getting a mite tedious at this point, isn't it?
Well, let me look at my script. Well, we still have to get through the three pages where we go back and forth on why goats need roughage, like grass and hay, and then there's the bit where... Oh, no!
What?
Dave ate my script.
Seriously?
Yeah, afraid so.
So no punchline?
Well, what does your script say?
I don't have a script.
Wait, why don't you have a script?
I don't want to talk about it.
Wait, what? You don't want to talk about it? What's that supposed to mean?
Look, it doesn't matter. How about we just finish with a silly noise or something, and that'll be that.
A silly noise? Look, I want to know why you don't have your script. Did you lose it?
Well, no, not exactly.
Then what happened to it?
Look, don't worry about it, okay?
Don't worry about it? How can I not worry about it? If you've lost your script, then you've lost your script. That's no big deal. But the fact that you won't tell me what happened has me darn well interested.
Okay, well, have you ever seen the movie Fire in the Sky?
Is that the one about the guy who was abducted by aliens?
That's the one.
Well, yeah, I think I saw it in the theater, but it was like, what, 95, 96?
1993.
Okay, well, still, that was a long time ago. What are you getting at?
I'm not really supposed to talk about it.
Are you trying to tell me that you were abducted by aliens?
I ain't telling you nothing. Like I said, I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Okay, so what does that have to do with your script? What, were you reading it at the time?
Look, I need to go. Can you just make a silly noise already so we can wrap this up?
Oh my goodness, this thing has gone off the freaking rails.
I know. But I'm no comedy writer. I don't know how to end this stupid thing.
And you think a silly noise will do it?
I don't know. But this is audio, ain't it? It's all I can think of.
But it's stupid. It makes no sense.
Well, nothing makes sense anymore.
Fine.
Yeah, you're right. That was pretty stupid.
Yep.
Sorry. Tell Dave I said hi.
Will do.
Bye.
Bye.
Me out, especially if the fish in question happens to be wearing a vest. You ever seen a fish in a vest? It's the stuff of nightmares. I understand that this fear is irrational and probably one I don't share with anybody else, but it's there all the same. I think it stems back to my childhood. My Uncle Joe was a taxidermist and he specialized in fish. Well, his opus creation was a school of trout made up to look like a motorcycle gang. On the day he finished his masterpiece, I got locked in the shop and had to spend the night in close quarters with the whole gang. Needless to say, I didn't sleep a wink for the next 12 years of my life.
30 Seconds of Nonsense has been brought to you by the Thomas Turlington School of Taxidermy. Register today and you'll be stuffing animals by dinner. Take off, you hoser. Those four words are iconic, right? Just hearing Rick Moranis call someone a hoser in that thick Canadian accent sent me rolling on the floor, giggling my 11-year-old butt off. And honestly, it still gets me. There's something so perfect about it. This weirdly innocent insult that's delivered with such sincerity by Moranis as Bob McKenzie. That's just one of the reasons why today we're diving into one of the most ridiculous yet endearing comedies to ever come out of Canada. Strange Brew, starring Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas as the legendary McKenzie brothers. Strange Brew isn't just any comedy. It's a cult classic. If you're a fan of the film or even just vaguely familiar with it, you already know that Bob and Doug McKenzie, as characters, were already kind of a big deal by the time this movie hit the theaters. These characters started out as a popular comedy sketch on the Canadian show SCTV, that's Second City Television for the uninitiated. Thomas and Moranis played these stereotypical Canadians who loved beer, hockey, and insulting each other in the most Canadian way possible, with lots of A's, and hoser's thrown in.
You had a nervous breakdown, eh? Me too, when he was born.
Take off, you hoser.
The McKenzie brothers became so popular that they ended up with a whole album, The Great White North, which even earned them a Grammy nomination. So when a feature-length movie was announced, fans were primed to see these hosers on the big screen. But Strange Brew isn't just some slapped-together comedy sketch stretched out to 90 minutes. It's a quirky, surprisingly well-thought-out story, complete with an absurd plot that's loosely, and I mean very loosely, based on Hamlet. Yeah, you heard that right. Shakespeare's Hamlet. The writers and directors, Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis, themselves crafted this elaborate storyline that sees our heroes stumbling into a world of corporate intrigue and murder, all set against the backdrop of a brewery, naturally. I mean, why wouldn't you use a brewery if you're going to film a Canadian comedy? So the story kicks off with Bob and Doug, two dim-witted but lovable beer enthusiasts who find themselves on a mission to get some free beer after blowing all their money on donuts. Their scheme is classic McKenzie. They shove a live mouse into an empty beer bottle and take it to the Elsinore Brewery, where they try to convince the staff that they found a mouse in their beer and should be compensated with a case of free suds.
We found this mouse in a bottle of Elsinore beer that we bought at your beer store, eh? And we heard, like, when that happens, that you get your beer free.
It's in the Canadian Criminal Code, eh? Yeah. Like, there's legal precedent setting cases in law.
So, like, give us our free beer.
But this ain't just any brewery, and things start to take a weird turn when they find themselves in the middle of a sinister plot. Here's where the Hamlet aspect comes in. The brewery's original owner, like King Hamlet, has died under mysterious circumstances. And his brother, Claude Elsinore, has taken over the company, even marrying the dead man's widow in the process. So right there, we have the first of several nods to Shakespeare. But Claude isn't the only bad guy. He's got a partner in crime, Brewmeister Smith, played by none other than the legendary Max von Sydow. And let me say, von Sydow as Brewmaster Smith is probably one of the most hilariously villainous characters in any comedy. Von Sydow usually played serious, intense roles in movies like The Seventh Seal or The Exorcist. So seeing him here as this mad scientist type who wants to take over the world by mind-controlling people through beer, well, that's pure gold as far as I'm concerned.
Now bring the lunatics from the Institute. I want to see how the drug and the beer is affecting them.
And this brings us to the film's big evil plan. Brewmeister Smith has developed a chemical that makes people susceptible to mind control, and he's planning to distribute it by spiking Elsinore beer. Once people drink the beer, he'll use music to trigger them into becoming hockey-playing zombies. That's right, zombies. This mad genius wants to control people so they'll play hockey, Canada's most beloved national sport. It's ridiculous, but it's also kind of brilliant in how it pokes fun at Canadian culture in the most loving way possible. Now, while the McKenzies might not be the brightest guys around, they're good-hearted and somehow always manage to bumble their way through these crazy situations. They're joined by Pam, the daughter of the late brewery owner, who's out to get justice for her father's death, and by Jean Rosie LaRose, a former hockey player turned brewery employee who's had his own run-ins with Brewmeister Smith's chemical experiments. Together, this unlikely team sets out to stop Claude and Brewmeister Smith from using their mind-controlled hockey army to take over, well, Canada, and maybe the world. Now, if there's one line from Strange Brew that perfectly captures the spirit of the movie, it's got to be this.
My brother and I used to say that drowning in beer was like heaven, eh? Now he's not here and I got two soakers. This isn't heaven, this
Don't
sucks.
Talk.
This line delivered by Bob while he and Pam are trapped in a tank filling up with beer is just priceless. They're knee-deep in beer, and instead of panicking, he's complaining about his wet socks. It's such a perfect blend of dark humor and Canadian politeness in the face of danger. And really, it's moments like this that give Strange Brew its charm. It's funny, sure, but it also has a bit of heart in it, even if it's a goofy heart. One thing I've always loved about Strange Brew is how it starts. Right off the bat, you're thrown into this absurd world of the McKenzie brothers. The film opens with Bob and Doug hosting an episode of their TV show, The Great White North, where they screen their own movie, a hilariously low-budget sci-fi flick set in a dystopian future. But the real kicker? We quickly learn that what we're watching is actually a movie within a movie, as the camera zooms out to reveal Bob and Doug sitting in a theater filled with angry patrons booing their homemade film. It's such a great way to set the tone, letting the audience know this movie is going to be goofy, meta, and full of the same irreverent humor that made the McKenzies famous. And then there's the courtroom scene. Bob and Doug end up on trial, accused of kidnapping, and their lawyer ends up dealing with the press in the most McKenzie way possible, by kung fu fighting them off as he leads his clients up the courthouse steps. It's random, it's over the top, and it's totally fitting for this movie.
Remind me to pay his bill on time, eh?
Yeah. Chuck Norris for the defense, eh?
Beauties.
These scenes are part of why Strange Brew has such a special place in my heart. It's one of those movies that I watched on repeat as a kid, back when I didn't need complex plots or character development. Just some good laughs, silly accents, and plenty of absurdity. Strange Brew has stayed with me over the years, probably because it's one of those rare movies that doesn't take itself seriously at all, yet manages to be memorable. It's a nostalgic piece for anyone who loves goofy movies or grew up with the McKenzie brothers. And the fact that it's Canadian to its core only makes it more endearing. Canada gave a lot to us with this one. Two iconic characters, quotable lines, and a weirdly charming plot about beer, mind control, and hockey. If you haven't seen Strange Brew, do yourself a favor and check it out. It's not just a relic of the 80s, it's a genuine piece of comedy that still holds up. Whether you're a fan of SCTV or just in the mood for something silly, it's one of those comedies that gets better with each watch. There's a reason why it's a cult classic and why fans like me keep coming back to it, chuckling at the same jokes and quoting the same lines decades later. So in the words of the great Bob and Doug, take off, eh? But not until you've watched Strange Brew and given it the appreciation that it deserves. Let me tell you something, folks. I am an old man. I mean, in my heart, I'm 23 years old, but the rest of me is feeling like I'm pushing 90. Though, technically, I'm not quite there yet. Not that it makes a lick of difference. I mean, I could be 50 or 150, and it really wouldn't matter, folks, because I have to face up to the fact that I just don't have the energy to go out and do stuff like I used to. Heck, in my 20s, I played in a metal band. We practiced 3 nights a week, 3 hours per practice, and we toured live clubs and, you know, all that stuff. I mean, dang, folks, it was just 8 years ago that I was still competing professionally as a member of the National TV Show Binge Watching League, or the NTVSBLW. And that took like, it took like a ton of energy. You didn't know about my time in the NTVSBLW? Well, I have a tape somewhere. Unfortunately, pretty much everything from my time with the NTVSBLW is gone. Countless hours of television and radio broadcasts of all the various events I competed in over the years, they've all been lost. Lost to the annals of time. The annals of time. Sounds a bit naughty, doesn't it? Well, it's not. Annals refers to a chronological record of events often used to describe historical accounts or records of activities. It does not, in this case, have anything to do with my posterior. But again, you know, participating in the NTVSBLW is all about having a strong back and one dynamically durable derriere. Anyway, I found the tape, but, you know, I don't quite remember what my point here was. I mean, sure, I found this tape, and I'm going to play the tape for you, but I started this little bit here with a comment about getting old, and good Lord, for the life of me, I can't remember where I was going with that. I guess that's all a part of getting old, right? Anyway, since I have the tape, and since I can't recall what my original point was, I guess I should just play the tape. I mean, it's not much, but hey, it ain't nothing.
Welcome once again to the annual binge-watching championship. I'm Chuck Bland, and joining me this afternoon is my colleague and all-around swell guy, Tom Stale.
Thanks, Chuck. It's always a pleasure. And what a beautiful day it is for binging some TV.
It certainly is, Tom. The sun is shining, there's a cool breeze blowing gently from the east, and the birds are singing their singy songs. Thankfully, we're inside and don't have to put up with all that.
Too true, Chuck. Too true. Nothing like a bit of sunshine to put a damper on some truly epic TV binging.
And speaking of epic binging, Tom, we have a real treat for everyone today.
That's right, Chuck. Today, to binge Iron Fist Season 2 on Netflix, hailing from the hills of eastern Kansas, we have returning champ, Stephen R. Orr.
This is truly a historical event, Tom, as this will be the first time that Orr has binged a television show professionally since his accident back in 09.
Too true, Chuck. And I think I speak for the entire nation when I say how saddened we were on that day in July when Stephen had his fall.
You certainly speak for me, Tom. Worse than the sorrow, however, more bitter than the anguish, were the inevitable questions. There was a mystery surrounding that day. What happened exactly that took Orr out of the game for almost a decade?
Thankfully, Chuck, we can now finally answer those questions.
That's right, Tom. Last week, our very own Ronnie Chump caught up with Orr as he trained for today's event.
It's 10:30 in the morning as I join legendary binger Stephen R. Orr on a bus stop bench in the middle of the city. The cars zoom past as he sits stoically, straight-backed, the tension showing on his face as his training reaches hour 7. What is it about this bench, Stephen, that helps you prepare for next week's binge?
Well, it's simple, Ronnie. Bus stop benches are known around the world as being some of the most uncomfortable places to sit.
And that discomfort helps you?
It sure does.
How?
Well, the couch I'll be using in next week's binge is quite plump and rather soft. It should contour itself to the shape of my back as I watch almost 10 hours of television. If I can sit here on this hard, unforgiving bench for 10 hours, then the couch should be a piece of cake.
If you could take us through the events that led to your downfall that week in 09, what happened? What have you learned since? And how will next week differ?
What you have to understand, Ronnie, is that I was trying for a record. I had attempted to watch the first 4 seasons of 24 in just one sitting. That's nearly 3 days worth of television. Iron Fist Season 2 is just 10 episodes. A walk in the park when you compare the two.
So what happened?
I was cocky, too sure of myself. I thought I was invincible. After all, I had successfully binged 2 seasons of Alias without blinking an eye. But 4 seasons of episodes, 24 per season? Well, it was impossible. By Season 3, it was all I could do to keep my eyes open. But it was 2 episodes into Season 4 when my back seized up on me. The pain, it was just so intense. I couldn't move. And then the true horror happened. I had to use the restroom. But I just couldn't pull myself up off that couch. In the end, I had to call time out, call for the medic. It was humiliating.
But now you're back.
I've had nearly 10 years to figure out who I was, Ronnie, what I wanted. I'm a different person now with different goals.
And you're confident that you can sit through all 10 episodes of Iron Fist Season 2?
I am, Ronnie. I've never been more sure of anything in my entire life.
You heard it here first, folks. Back to the studio.
Bold words for sure, Tom.
They certainly are, Chuck. They certainly are.
And here comes Orr now, striding confidently out onto the field, his 32-ounce mug of Diet Mountain Dew gripped firmly in one hand, the universal remote in the other.
Well, he definitely looks ready to conquer the world, Chuck. Look at him. He hit play on the remote before he even sat down. Now that's confidence.
It certainly is, Tom. And now, as he takes his seat and we hear that all-too-familiar twin percussive blasts that heralds a Netflix original, the crowd goes silent and the real show begins.
There you go, folks, the end of the show. Next week, you can look forward to even more auditory awesomeness as I dive into Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 1 before telling you all about alligator snapping turtles and their tongues. Plus, you'll get more Franks and Beans, another installment of Podcasting Through Time, 30 more seconds of nonsense, and a look at a movie about a world where the wheel hasn't been invented. Fire is still a mystery, and the English language is reduced to grunts, gibberish, and the occasional enthusiastic zug-zug. Until then, folks, I leave you with this one last thought. Walking through the parking lot of a Walmart is the wrong time to be focused on your inner self. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's going to get you run over. Be nice to each other. Bye. I want to thank you for listening to Stephen Or Else. This episode was written, performed, produced, engineered, and edited by me, Stephen Orr. Questions and comments can be directed to StephenOrElse@gmail.com, or you can find me online at all the regular places by searching for @StephenOrElse. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen Or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Stephen Or Else, along with every other show under the Stephen Or Else Media umbrella, early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes or just go to StephenOrElse.com to join today. The Stephen Or Else podcast is a presentation of Stephen Or Else Media. For more nerdy content created by me, check out SoManyPodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes.
I don't think I could move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Hail to the king, baby.
Steven! Thank God. I had a horrible feeling I was going to be the only one here.
There's always next time, Steven.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.